You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, June 27th, 2016. I am Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Bhaskar Sankara, the founder of Jacobin Magazine, he's giving us a Marxist tour of a globe in crisis. What happens next in the United States? Between far-right reactionary politics, center-right status quo politics, the Brexit, election results in Spain. We'll take note of the contradictions and tensions at this point in the global scene with Bhaskar. Also, a human rights activist, environmental activist, was gunned down in Honduras a couple weeks ago, and now a whistleblower who is, for obvious reasons, remaining anonymous, has told The Guardian that he was part of an elite military squad that was trained in the United States that had a hit list of environmentalist leaders to kill in Honduras. And that he has no doubt that this leader was a victim of that military squad. Incidentally, this all traces back to the coup against Manuel Zelaya. Also, DNC Platform Committee, some good, some bad. We'll get to that. Jesse Williams is blowing up with an incredible speech at the BET Awards. Touch on that. And all of Hillary Clinton's potential VP picks are really committed to demonstrating how boring they are. Boring. It's boring. You're boring. Say something funny. I don't quite get it. Maybe they see a secret appeal in being dull, conventional wisdomites in a time of total upheaval. Interesting take. And Iraqi forces have retaken Fallujah from Daesh, ISIL, ISIS, whatever that group of assholes' names is. They took that city back using Shiite militias and Iraqi forces. What happens next? Will the underlying problems of Sunni disenfranchisement be addressed, even as we celebrate the removal of ISIL? And of course, your IMs, your phone calls, and all of our hijinks on today's Majority Report. New Two Dope Boys dropping tomorrow. This last week, got some notes and some feedback from people who finally got on board and subscribed to it. And fortunately, it was all positive. Really excited about it. Hyung Kim is the crew member for Tuesday. We had a conversation about virtual reality and social justice and reinventing masculinity, among other topics. And on Thursday, we have a woman called Marjan. Marjan.
Marjan Kennedy.
Marjan Kennedy on her reinventing the children's book genre, which is really interesting. This is like the type of conversation I did not expect to get into, but it's fascinating. Subscribe, number two, Dope Boys and a Podcast. We're going to get to, on iTunes, to Dope Boys and a Podcast, number two, also available on Stitcher. Okay, so the next prime minister of the UK is very likely to be a guy named Boris Johnson. And if you voted for Brexit, there's a lot of complexities to this. We'll get to those complexities with Bhaskar. But the most sort of practical part of your vote in some ways, besides potentially totally tanking the UK economy and splitting the country up, but the most like almost definite certitude of what is going to happen because of this vote is that a guy named Boris Johnson is going to become the next prime minister of the UK. And you just participated in essentially an elaborate internal coup in the UK's Tory party, the UK's Conservative Party. So David Cameron's resigning. Boris Johnson, who was the former mayor of London and pretty popular. He's been compared to Donald Trump. There's some truth in the sense that he's a colorful, narcissistic, tabloid kind of figure. Besides that, it's a stupid comparison in many ways. He's very, very smart, and he's been extraordinarily politically effective and popular.
His hair is crazy, though.
But it's his hair.
Right.
There you go. Exactly. So there are similarities and not similarities. But one area that I just wanted to touch on, because it really gives you a sense of this guy. This is a guy who throughout his career has, you know, been fired from various positions. He's had controversies in his journalistic past. He's, you know, he's certainly, I'm not into moralizing, but he's certainly, like, you know, gotten married woman pregnant while cheating on his wife. He's a colorful guy. And one of the things that he did, and this is only in the UK could this exist, because of course Boris Johnson, like David Cameron, is of the sort of like PG Woodhouse elite that you think only exists in like PBS costume dramas, but actually still exists in the UK. So he went to college at Oxford, of course, with a guy named Darius Guppy. I'm just going to repeat that. His name was literally Darius Guppy. And not his name was literally Darius Guppy. His name was Darius Guppy. And Darius Guppy and Boris enjoyed themselves in college. They destroyed eating rooms together. They did a lot of drinking. And then they went their sort of separate ways. And Boris became a journalist. And Darius, well, despite being a good Oxford man, or probably because of being a good Oxford man, he got himself into some legal trouble. And there was a journalist from the News and World Reporter, News of the World, named Stuart Collier, who was aggressively reporting on Darius Guppy. Now, Guppy would later in 1993 be jailed for insurance fraud, but this is a phone call in 1990 of Darius Guppy calling up his old chum, Boris Johnson, to see if Boris could help get the information that he needed on Stuart Collier so he could send a group of guys to beat him to a pulp on the street. This is your next UK prime minister. It's Boris, the one who's the journalist who Darius is asking for the address of the other reporter from, and Darius Guppy, his college chum. I don't know what his position on Brexit was, but this is them in 1990.
Boris, have you got this number?
Drug. Look, there is a guy at the moment going through his file at home.
But I am telling you something, Boris. This guy has got my blood up, all right? And there is nothing which I won't do to get my revenge. It's as simple as that.
How badly are you going to hurt this guy?
Not badly.
I want to know.
Okay, let me explain this.
If this guy is serious, I'm fucking curious.
I guarantee you, he will not be serious.
Badly hurt.
He will not have a broken limb or broken arm. He will not. He will not be put into intensive care or anything like that. He will probably get a couple of black eyes and a cracked rib. Nothing which you didn't suffer in rugby, okay? But he'll get scared, and that's what I want him to do. I want him to get scared. I want him to have no idea who's behind it. Okay.
Sorry, if I get.
You will not, Boris. I swear to you. If you knew.
Yeah, I'm not complaining. I got this bloody number for you. Don't worry. Okay, Darry. I thought I'll do it. Don't worry.
Boris, I really mean it. I love you.
Aww. There's real friendship and camaraderie there. I love how he says, Boris, though, is showing his leadership traits. He's very judicious. He's like, wait a second, how badly are you going to hurt this guy? And Guppy helpfully says, oh, nothing they wouldn't counter on the rugby field. Your next UK Prime Minister. We'll be right back with Bhaskar Sankara.
Caballero, ahí acaba entrar Guatusi, ese mulato que mide 7 pies y pesa 169 libras. Y cuando ese mulato llega al solar, todo el mundo dice, a correr, que ahí llegó Guatusi, el hombre más guapo de La Habana. Guatusi,
¿qué quiere?
Oye, me dicen que tú eres guapo.
¿A mí? mí todo me tiene miedo.
No me digas que a ti te tiene miedo porque yo sé que me fajo con cualquiera.
Más grande que yo no hay ninguno.
Ah, ah, ah. Vamos a fajarnos.
Cuando quieras.
Nos fajamos, Guatuz.
Ah.
Nos bebemos la sangre aquí ahora mismo. ¿Qué es lo que pasa?
Nada.
Saca lo que tengo encima, que yo no te tengo miedo a ti.
Palo nada más.
Todo el mundo te tiene miedo en La Habana, caballero, pero yo...
Siete pies tengo yo.
A mí no me importa que tú tengas siete pies. ¿Qué es lo que pasa? ¿Qué es lo que pasa, Guatuz? Dime. Conmigo no, porque yo de los guapos me río. Ah, 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 ah. Como te me río en la cara, Guatuz.
A correr.
Bien. Nos bajamos, nos bajamos.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Carlito's Way fans will appreciate that music. Joining us now is Bhaskar Sunkara. He is the founder, chief editor, and publisher of what I would call really the indispensable Jacobin magazine. Bhaskar, how you doing, man?
Thanks for having me on again.
It's a pleasure. So I wanted to talk to you about this sort of broad moment of crisis that we're in. I think that this is a moment that is very ripe for your sort of particular analytic perspective, because I think that a lot of the sort of tensions and contradictions that you guys cover a lot are very evident right now, and things could really break in many different directions. And so let's start briefly with the United States, which in some ways is, I guess, you know, maybe in some respects less explosive than Europe, but still quite explosive. We have a situation where, you know, I know some people sort of cling to hope that there'll be some type of indictment or something. I'm not sort of interested in that process, to be perfectly blunt. I know that annoys people. But I think the reality is that Hillary Clinton is going to be the Democratic nominee, and we're going to have a presidential election that pits the sort of xenophobic reactionary right against the center right status quo. And in a sort of broad strokes, what is your angle and what perspective would you take on that matchup while sort of also, I think, hopefully being mindful that even as it ends for a lot of people in really bitter disappointment, that actually Bernie Sanders' campaign has been, from a kind of large historical perspective, I think an unparalleled success for a certain type of at least genuine kind of soft socialism in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what was key about the Sanders campaign, if there's one takeaway that I think we really need to cling to, it's that he spoke to people's anger. He wasn't just telling people, you know, here's this warm and fuzzy future that we should all kind of walk towards together hand in hand. He was telling people that there is a group of enemies out there. There are a group of people, he called them, you know, the millionaire and billionaire class, that have a vested interest in making sure that we don't have nice things, you know, and making sure that we don't have universal health care and universal pre-K and all these other, you know, necessities that's available in, you know, a lot of other welfare states. So I think we need to remember that he spoke to people's anger. People are kind of looking for someone to blame. And, you know, with Bernie Sanders, you know, we really saw that, and we saw that articulated from the left. Now, what I'm concerned about is that now we're going to be in a situation where American politics are going to start to resemble something like French politics, where you see a lot of this anti-establishment energy being monopolized by this kind of pseudo-populism of the right, with people like Le Pen and the National Front. And the biggest danger that I can imagine happening, I actually don't think that Trump has a credible chance of being president.
No, I agree entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's somewhat controversial. I'm not saying it to kind of demobilize people. I think we need to go out there and we need to continue, you know, protesting Trump and doing the rest. But I think we're going to be in a situation where you have this xenophobic right getting 40 to 45% of the vote, and the center able to cohere to make sure the right doesn't get a majority. Similar situation what you saw in France, but in that
several years ago, you're talking about this was I assume you're referring to there was an they have a runoff system. There was Lionel Jospin, who was the sort of center-left candidate. You had President Chirac at the time, and then you had Marie Le Pen's father. And it ended up being Le Pen versus Chirac. So you had a general election without a socialist. You had a general election between the center-right and the far-right. And yes, many people on the left obviously went to vote for Chirac to prevent a genuine neo-fascist from becoming president of France.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that tactical voting in France made sense. But, you know, the real danger is that, yeah, that's essentially the scenario where you're going to have a polarization between the center right and the right, and all the anger and discontent being articulated on the right. So that's what I'm afraid of. And that's why I think now more than ever, if you want to defeat the far right in the United States, it's important that we make sure that we have our independent identity on the left. Mm. So we can't have a situation where liberals and leftists kind of unite in a kind of very neat and friendly popular front, because what that essentially means in practice is that we go back to just saying that we're liberals. And that was one of the nice things when I was at the People's Summit last weekend, you know, back the 18th and 19th. What was really nice is that people would talk about don't trust liberals, don't trust this, don't trust this. And obviously this is a gathering of, you know, rank and file nurses, other trade unionists, social movement activists. So these aren't like, you know, crazy ultra leftists. These are people who just have developed a distinct identity to the left of mainstream liberalism and consider themselves part of the left. And I think there's a lot of Americans, it turns out, that are a lot more attracted to our brand of politics and what we have to offer than we're attracted to the very tepid liberalism of Obama or Clinton. So I think it's important that we maintain that identity.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So let's actually pick apart two of the things that you isolated there, and then actually we can sort of expand the conversation to Brexit. I was going to say the Eurozone, but I guess not the Eurozone anymore. So there are two different tracks there. I think one thing that you're identifying, and maybe you're already speaking to, but I'd like you to elaborate on, I'll start first on this, is there a way of having sort of cohesion without unity, or alliance without fusion? I hear the sort of, you know, and we've had this debate on the show many times, these sort of Bernie or bust debates, and I've never heard any sound strategic reason for, you know, frankly, just not selecting Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump in terms of the practicality of this election. It always seems very kind of emotional to me. But the most salient thing that I've heard, which I think you're pointing to, is, well, what does this mean? Is this just like, you know, we all go to the, you know, DNC, or we watch it in various bars in coastal cities, and, you know, all together now because we're sort of like generally kind of like decent people who don't hate Mexicans and aren't bigots, and we have gay friends, you know, and we got to stop this, you know, ridiculous, like, you know, orange trust fund baby from becoming president, right? Or do we do this in the way you're talking about, where we need to make a tactical decision, but actually in the longer term, the tectonic plates of American politics are splitting? And I think that it has something to do also with just an understanding of a power versus efficiency, that arguments are not about the most efficient modes of delivery. And, you know, that's like this kind of liberal obsession with rationality and crunching the numbers outside of a vacuum of really understanding. No, there are serious power disparities here, which Bernie Sanders really did hammer home, as you were pointing out earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say this. Voting is a tactical decision, and that's the decision you do last. You know, that's a decision that happens in November. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about what you do between now and November. I do think it matters as far as analysis that it does seem like Clinton is going to go to have a comfortable victory. Mm-hmm. That matters because it means that I don't think it's our job to go canvass and, you know, really recruit votes for Clinton directly. I think it's our job to go expose Donald Trump, expose his contradictions, expose kind of the lies that he's peddling to people, and also at the same time, make sure that Clinton doesn't backtrack and move to the right. Because, you know, the main thing in the mind of every single Democratic DNC type, is that we're going to win this election because we're going to win places like the suburbs of Cincinnati.
Yep.
We're going to win the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and then the Virginia side. We're going to win a lot of these areas where there's some, you know, Mitt Romney-type Republicans, traditional Republican voters, that can't stomach Trump.
Right.
So the main thing they want to do is they might make some concessions. And by the way, if you look at these platform fights, it doesn't look like they're actually making many concessions.
No, they're not.
They're already
right.
They already want to put Bernie Sanders and Warren in the you know, and all these other kind of cohering left of their party in the rearview mirror, maybe throw a few symbolic things, put them in the rearview mirror, then go ahead to try to court these center right voters. So that's their game. We already know what they're planning. We need to figure out a way to make sure that the Bernie agenda is still kind of alive in some way. And we make sure that all those people that were mobilized around a certain set of demands are actually still pushing for them. So I think it's kind of a two-front, you know, attack. I think we need to keep, you know, the fire on Clinton, because if we don't, here's actually the great irony of this all. If we do what a lot of people, a lot of liberals want us to do, and just stop criticizing Clinton from now until November or God knows how long, essentially,
yeah, just through her second term,
doubling down. Yeah, we're just going to be doubling down on the conditions that created Trump to begin with. So
right,
that's why
exactly,
I think it's, you know,
exactly.
So,
that is such an important point, because what they are doing, it's not just about the internal conflict between left and you know, neoliberal, whatever you want to call it. It is that precisely the conditions that generate this, you know, this bigoted buffoon being in a position to actually, you know, be a Republican nominee, is, of course, it's primarily Republicans' fault, but it's absolutely co-created by the nature of the modern Democratic Party. That's a very important point.
Yeah, absolutely. So on this tactical questions, you know, if you're in Virginia, I'm not going to tell you to vote for Joe Stein. You know, I'm not. If you're in Virginia, you're in Ohio, but I'm also not going to admonish people who just say that, you know, I can't do it, I just have to stay at home or whatever, because it's not my job. If Clinton wants to win those voters, she has to make her pitch and appeal and figure out a way to try to win those voters. I don't think that's the job of the left to kind of guilt and kind of drag people in that direction. You know, personally, I'm in New York. I have an easier decision. But voting is the very last decision. It's a tactical decision. I think that it's much more important that we actually...
You'll be writing in Herman Cain.
right,
yeah,
exactly. Right.
Yeah, we talked about that. I'm a little confused by it, Bhaskar, but... Yeah, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, Herman Cain did have some merits to him, you know. I mean, I'm a big fan of pizza. I don't like what he did with pizza.
Yeah, he was not.
I'm a fan.
He was a greater insult to pizza than American democracy. I mean, I think, and I want you to open this up to a conversation on Brexit, though, is I think the one area that I think you and I, there's some differences. I mean, one difference is I do think it's actually, you know, worth having a debate or worth admonishing people that I think are not thinking in the long term about the implications of, you know, handing the keys of everything to Republicans. I think that is a real debate and a real conversation that's worth having. But, and the other thing that I wonder about, and I think we saw this in Brexit, is, you know, that this has actually been a mainstream narrative in some ways, and it's different from what you're saying, but it's like the parallels between Trump and Bernie are so tenuous, because the reality is, and we see this all across the world, that yes, there is this, in one sense, you can look at the discontent as just sort of elites in a certain sense versus everybody else, however you want to define elites. And basically it's this, you know, Glenn Greenwald had a column over the weekend that, like, Brexit is just the next example of this sort of globalized failure of every type of institution you can imagine that holds sort of mainstream Western consensus. And that has led to everything from, you know, blown up financial markets to beyond medieval levels of inequality to, you know, Iraq invasions, right? But then on the other hand, they're In the analysis that sort of says that the xenophobic right and the genuine left are sort of two sides of the same coin, you've done such a good work in sort of really disaggregating, making that parallel, because they're quite different responses. So I want, maybe you could sort of speak to that here and then maybe pivot us into Brexit through that lens.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's key that, you know, we're not for just anger for the sake of anger. We can understand anger. We understand where it's coming from. Well, we do care a lot about the political articulation of that anger. So right. Often, for example, I'll give, this sounds like an aside, but I think this gets to the point. The Tea Party. When the Tea Party first emerged, I think there was an attempt by a lot of people, a lot of liberals, a lot of other progressives to basically say, all right, the Tea Party is entirely astroturf. Mm-hmm. You know, of course it had funding or whatnot, but no, the Tea Party.
There was a lot of turf. Movement. Yeah. Yeah, but I hear
there,
you.
There was mm-hmm. some turf, but it was mm-hmm. it was a grassroots movement, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. the KKK in the 1920s was a grassroots movement. So the whole point is that, you know, there's been plenty of grassroots movements throughout history that have been terrible and right. worthy of opposition.
Right.
But I think at the same time, you have to understand where, let's say in the United Kingdom, where someone's, you know, feeling kind of post-industrial devastation, they're feeling all these anxieties, and they have no power. They don't have any savings. They don't have any money in an investment account, so they don't care if the markets are going to crash. And, you know, this, and beyond, yes, a lot of the voters were voting for very, you know, for chauvinistic nationalist reasons. You know, other of them were voting for kind of other reasons, just to kind of, you know, say F you to their political leaders and you know, strike back in some sort of way, right?
Right.
At the same time, we could say that, you know, the way that these things are being articulated, it is in a way that helps kind of no one. It's in a destructive way. But I think we have to see this as kind of the symptom, and we have to see the real cause as this, like, really bad neoliberal consensus in the center, and we mm-hmm. have to figure out how to build politics that'll be better than this neoliberal consensus, not build politics that reacts to it by kind of driving things further towards xenophobia and the right and all sorts of dead ends. So I think that's kind of balance. It does relate very much to how we respond to this Clinton-Trump moment. And I don't think it's a matter of just saying that, you know, we need to rally around the lesser evil completely uncritically. It also mm-hmm. doesn't mean that we have to spout lies and says Trump is the same as Clinton, the Democratic Party is right. the same as the Republican Party. No, right. they're different. You know, right. they are different. But that shouldn't, you know, be the only thing we're saying here.
Absolutely. And I think in parallel to that, and again, I want you to maybe open up with the sort of what is the left opportunity in Brexit, and maybe also touch on what's happening in the Labour Party right now, because that's quite relevant to this conversation. But I think that what you just said needs to be underlined, because this is actually really what came through in Brexit, that maybe, you know, there are some people on the left that had problems with the European Union, you know, for a variety of reasons. Although, frankly, if you're, you know, I wouldn't blame the EU for austerity in the UK. That's really wrongheaded. But obviously, you can blame it for what it's done to the southern zone countries. And but there was this notion of, yes, the EU is a sort of top-down kind of austerity-driving organization, even though I think that the EU's sort of full policy package is more complex than that. But you had people who wanted to go above and beyond the EU, like you're talking about. But then the Brexit campaign, of course, wasn't just, it was driven probably primarily, you know, in voting by populism, by legitimate anger, by reaction, and by xenophobia, for sure. But then the leaders of it, like Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, are actually like, they want to lower the standards of the EU. Like, they want a trade commons without, you know, environmental standards and animal rights and open borders and all the rest. So in that tactical alliance, the result is, you know, the standards decrease.
Right, right. I mean, I think that, so yes, it is key and it's important to actually make this distinction between the European Union and the Eurozone. Mm-hmm, right, mm-hmm. I think that is important.
Yes.
So Britain wasn't a member of the Eurozone. As a result, I think you have to say, like you were alluding to, the neoliberal austerity in Britain is a homegrown problem.
Right.
It's not a problem imposed by the EU. That being said, there are all sorts of institutional ways, and the EU as a whole has hollowed out democracy at a continental level mm-hmm. and made it so that if we did have a left government, if we did have a Corbyn-led government, for example, the leader of the UK Labour Party, if he was in power, then he would be constrained and corralled by the EU in these kind of institutional arrangements. So I do think there was a real case for a left exit. Mm-hmm. That being mm-hmm. said, that case wasn't made by enough of the left. It wasn't made by the Labour Party. Corbyn, who I think, you know, his default and traditionally has been to have roughly my view on the European Union, he was kind of
which is opposed, which is sort of a, which is
which
opposed,
is, which yeah. is yeah, which is yeah. in opposition to it,
right?
You know, from the left, mm-hmm. he was kind of blackmailed by the Labour Party, you know, bureaucracy into going into the Remain camp, and we could debate kind of like how that emerged, but as a result, there was no real large voices on the left from organized labor, from all these other sources, pushing for leave. And the leave campaign was dominated by xenophobic and racist elements. And it's very telling that, you know, this is just days after a center-left pro-immigrant member of parliament was assassinated by a leave supporter, by a kind of far-right nationalist. This vote actually went through. I mean, even in the United States, I would imagine that would have been a huge kind of swing. So I think it is.
Yeah, I think that would really hurt Trump here. I think you're right.
Yeah, the depth of the anger, you know, I think that's really telling. I think now we're in a situation, though, where, you know, all right, we could have debates over leave or remain. There were a couple people on the British left who still, while acknowledging the kind of state of the leave campaign, still thought that they couldn't in good conscience vote for Remain, given what the EU was. The majority position, though, was to be in the Remain camp. I probably would have been, you know, abstaining or not, you know, or it would be a very difficult situation that to choose from. But right now, the Leave vote kind of did win, and this is the political climate we're in. There needs to be organizing on the ground against racism, against xenophobia, while at the same time, there needs to also be massive amounts of support for Jeremy Corbyn. Because mm-hmm. Corbyn's now in
a coup now.
Well, he could actually, there's a coup, and it has nothing to do. The pretext of the coup is essentially Jeremy Corbyn.
Just to let people know, inside the Labour Party, just to set you up, Oshkar, inside the Labour Party, yeah. after the referendum, you know, after Leave won, the first move against Jeremy Corbyn, who, as you said before, I think Jeremy Corbyn, he's been campaigning against the EU for decades. I mean, going back to the 70s from a sort of left position. And so I don't think his sort of genuine convictions are that much of a mystery. But he campaigned on Remain. He made a good case for Remain, I think, from actually a kind of genuine center-left perspective, which isn't necessarily his perspective. But he did campaign for it. And then the response to the fail was, you know, from, you know, Tony Blair wrote a column, the former leader of the Labour Party, several people on the front bench, opposition bench resigned, was that he didn't make a strong enough case. So I just wanted to set up. Go ahead. So now there's this coup taking place.
Yeah, and first of all, that's just drawn on the face of it.
Right. Well,
maybe voters actually knew that in his heart, Corbyn wasn't really a Remainer. Maybe they saw that. But the telling thing is, in his home district, 75% voted Remain. And yes, his home district is in London, but the working class parts of his district also voted Remain mm-hmm. in a majority. Mm-hmm. Whereas these MPs leading the revolt against him because of his lack of leadership, all their districts went Leave. That's completely ludicrous. And also the connection they're drawing that because of the failure of a David Cameron-led campaign to Remain, that Corbyn was assisting in, you know, David Cameron's the current prime minister, conservative. Because of his failure, that also shows the failure of Corbyn's leadership because he can't rally Labour voters to vote for Remain. If you actually look at the polling right now, and then they're saying that this shows that he's unelectable in a general election. If you look at the recent polling, in fact, Labour has actually made gains in recent days. And they're benefiting from some of the chaos in the Conservative Party. And right now they're in a dead heat. They're tied with the Conservatives. It looks like, you know, there's a possibility that Corbyn would be able to lead.
And just to say, there was one poll that came out just recently. There have been polls like you're saying. There was one poll that showed the Conservatives up a couple of points that came out like literally about like an hour ago. And I think, you know, arguably, I think it was certainly taken after the referendum. I don't know if it was taken when the coup started, but the coup started pretty closely after the referendum. If Labour starts to tumble and the lead opens up again, would it be because, you know, of Brexit, or would it be because the Labour Party people attempting to stage a coup right now are so politically irresponsible, frankly, regardless of what your perspective is, that their first reaction to a sort of, you know, global crisis situation for the UK is to try to dump their leader on spurious grounds? That doesn't exactly feed good poll numbers.
It doesn't inspire confidence. And remember this, I haven't seen that poll, but remember this. So it could just be an outlier. But
yeah,
also,
sure.
It's not a presidential system.
Yep.
People aren't going there voting for Jeremy Corbyn. A lot of these people, like, this is especially true of Labour voters in Scotland. My go-to from, you know, working class people that I know in Scotland that were traditional Labour voters and either moved over to the SNP or further to the left, basically say that, you know, if Corbyn was the choice, if he was running in my district, you know, we've known him for years, you know, we would definitely go ahead and vote for him, but they're not going to vote for their existing kind of decrepit Scottish Labour bureaucracy.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's on really weak ground. I think it's very important to say that if the left is going to benefit from this in any way, the left's going to be able to challenge UKIP and this right and a rightward-moving Tory party in the UK. It's going to happen through the Labour left. It's going to have to happen in large part with the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell and the other leaders on the Labour left. So I think that's the really where we should pivot. Instead of this kind of back and forth of admonishing voters or saying or joining in and this like really disgusting line of rhetoric that you see out there from the, Financial Times of the world or whatever, questioning democracy, you know, essentially,
right?
Because they don't like one choice by voters. The main thing is, if we actually made a more left case for leave, or if we made a more honest case for remain from the left, you know, either one, I'm not sure which side I would be on. I think I would lean towards if there was a left option to be before leave in a vote like this.
Mm-hmm.
Then the discourse would be different. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing in Britain is what happens when you leave the political sphere, if you leave this anger and resentment to the right. And really, the difference is made up by politics. And I think it should be a warning to those of us in the United States who want to just kind of sit back and rally behind Clinton, because she is, you know, a least bad option than Donald Trump. I think it really just shows the importance of maintaining some sort of independent politics.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, the other thing, and this will pivot us to Spain. Let's touch briefly on Spain and maybe contrast it with Greece. The other thing that's also, and I've had this conversation with a couple of people, you know, from Jeremy Corbyn's perspective, if he survives this coup, and I think you're right, in some, you know, coup aside, in some ways he might be better positioned than he has been before to actually become prime minister. Although I do think it's, you know, we shouldn't be naive about what a sort of hill that is to climb, but it's definitely within the realm of real possibility. Without that sort of, as you were alluding to earlier, I mean, he is going to have much more free rein if he is to govern from the actual left. The other thing about the UK is that there isn't the same nothing. I mean, when a party gets elected to government, they push their agenda through. This is like quite the opposite of the United States in terms of being able to implement a manifesto. Now that takes us to Spain.
Yeah, you don't have divided government.
You don't have divided government, and parliamentary rebellion is incredibly rare. So I mean, you know,
platforms actually kind of matter.
It's a very, very different system, and it's a system that also prizes loyalty so much that, you know, I've seen interviews with, you know, even Tony Blair post Corbyn, and he's like, well, I certainly hope everybody will still vote Labour. I mean, you know, even the fact that he feels compelled at a public platform to say that he's still a Labour guy just gives you a sense of sort of some of how political identity works in the UK as contrast from the United States. So
right.
Going to Spain, Podemos, which is the legitimate, you know, the left insurgent party in Spain. There were Spanish elections yesterday. The conservative governing party, they had their share to vote decrease, but they did win enough to still form another government. And the mainstream, quote-unquote mainstream center-left, still hung on. They were not overtaken by Podemos. So not by any means disastrous results. And in some respects, very Bernie parallel results. Podemos dominated with the youth. And it could just be a harbinger of the future. But it wasn't as great a result as they would hope. And I guess my question for you, I want you to explain Podemos in that situation a bit. But I'm also wondering, do you think that what's happened with Syriza, and without getting into all of the various internal politics of Syriza, but I think one justifiable conclusion of Syriza, which I think is actually generous to everybody, it's generous to Tsipras, it's generous to Varoufakis, and I hope obviously Varoufakis disagrees strongly with the way Tsipras has handled things, as I have as well. But one generic interpretation is that, look, if you're in the Eurozone, if you're in these agreements and frameworks, you're playing a certain sport. So if you're playing, you know, baseball, you can't show up with a tennis racket. And to kind of push that tortured analogy, there's something about pushing for genuine left reform when the rules of the road will just simply not allow it, which, again, going back to the UK, might be a reason why, of course, someone like Jeremy Corbyn would, in his heart of hearts, want to leave the EU, because he wants to do a real left agenda, which might not be possible in the current framework.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there's a few things to unwrap. One, yeah. I do think that Spain would be in a better position than Greece, by far, and given the size of their economy and whatnot, to pursue either their own economic program within the Eurozone, or even to pursue kind of a break with the Eurozone.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Spanish left, they aren't proposing kind of a break. They are proposing this kind of left Europeanism pushed by Syriza and others, which is essentially, let's kind of renegotiate the terms of our captivity so we get more freedom and flexibility, which, you know, we could debate, but that's kind of their perspective. So one thing in this election that was a big disappointment is that, you know, a few people have asked me even this morning, they said, why is everyone calling this a disaster? Didn't Podemos this year go from 69 seats to 71 seats?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a popular vote stable. This election was actually saw the unification of two different forces on the left. The traditional kind of left, this Izquierda Unida, this United Left formation that was kind of a mix of the Communist Party, Greens, and a lot of other forces. They were kind of the left before Syriza, left before Podemos, with Podemos. So if you have the combined total, it actually was a contraction of the vote from the left. But it's not because United Left or Podemos supporters abandoned the left for some other parties, decided to vote for the center-left Social Democrats or for the Conservative Party. It's actually because a lot of people just stayed at home.
Mm-hmm.
Turnout was low.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons why turnout was low was actually just because Iglesias and other Podemos leaders were very much framing their appeals this time around very pragmatically. They were saying, all right, we're going to form a coalition government with the support of the Social Democrats. Mm-hmm. We're going to end austerity. We're going to do this. But instead of just basically the old rhetoric, which basically said, you know, the political establishment is bankrupt, we're something new and fresh, and, you know, we're still kind of figuring it out, and we're going to do a good job, but we're, you know, we still are kind of figuring out some of the details, but you know what, we're not going to be corrupt, and we're going to do politics differently, and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
This traditional kind of insurgent Podemos appeal, they went for a more traditional kind of center-left appeal. We need a fourth social democracy. We're going to save the Social Democrats by preventing them from having to do an alliance with the Conservatives. We're going to, you know, so for a lot of people, this change in rhetoric meant that Podemos is no longer kind of a fresh thing. It's a party like any other, maybe a little bit further to the left, but a party that has a stable voting bloc and social base. And, you know, I don't think it would really fit the insurgent rhetoric that they had for the last election in late 2015. I do also think that, you know, an election coming 2 days after one of the biggest stock market drops in history is not good. And I think it does favor conservatives.
Yeah.
It did remind people that, like, you know, if you vote your anger, look what might happen. You know, all your savings and whatnot might evaporate. Mm-hmm. But that said, that explanation only goes so far, just because so many youth in Spain, more than a quarter, are unemployed. So many other people in Spain are pensioners, have risk of their pensions being cut and things like that. I think it was really just a lack of enthusiasm and a lack of turnout that hurt the left. But it's not a disastrous position. The far left is third. It's within striking distance of overtaking the center left. And we're in a situation where if the center left is forced to support austerity packages or even a government,
there that support goes.
Conservatives,
yep.
Yeah.
There it
if
goes.
They support that, then Podemos is, and Unidos Podemos is right there to pick up and make advances. So, mm-hmm. you know, it didn't happen at this moment. I think there's still a lot of hope and a lot of energy. People that I spoke to in Spain this morning are obviously disappointed, but by no means is kind of a disaster. Remember, they still have 71 seats, and you know, for the far left in a country, you know, having 71 seats when the ruling party is going to end up with 120 or so, you know, it's not that bad.
No, not disastrous even remotely. So, as a final question, Bhaskar, I just. Taking all of this together, and I think one of the things that we share in our analysis is, I mean, I have no problem being as snobby as the next dude who does this sort of thing and lives in New York, and I, you know, whatever, that's fine. But this sort of culture of dismissal that, yes, of course, there's people who back Donald Trump who are stupid and bigoted, and of course, you know, many people voted for Brexit, probably not even knowing what the EU is. And, you know, and all of these things are problems, and we can fairly critique them. But this cultural sort of orientation, which is so interesting because it filters down the line from the sort of, you know, occupying a great perch, like being a columnist at the Financial Times, to just even, you know, sort of like, you know, kind of like the sort of like busybodies of social media who want to sort of, you know, shame people for not being responsible. The sort of there's this kind of interesting cultural push that instead of confronting the range of the disgust and the rage, the good, the bad, the ugly, the justifiable, the right, and the properly aimed, and the disgusting, repulsive, and bigoted, but that there's this sort of this sort of entrenchment of people kind of across a certain cultural landscape of just sort of, oh, well, you know, these people are just idiots. They just don't understand. Not confronting the larger systemic failures that all of these shockwaves, the good ones and the terrible ones, are kind of signaling to us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? I feel like this political moment does remind me of kind of the Mike Judge political moment. It's
right.
Like Idiocracy.
Ugh.
You know, that movie and that
I
level.
I hate that
kind
movie,
of,
man.
I do too. It's why we're such good friends, I think.
Yes.
You know, but
exactly.
That really, because that's a common response. And in other words, I think there's a lot of people, some of them well-meaning, who are kind of looking at the situation and are basically saying there are two choices and there will forever be two choices. There's a kind of, whether they'll embrace it or not in these terms, I think this is what they mean. There's kind of the Singapore model of authoritarian, enlightened technocracy.
Yep.
And then there's democracy, and democracy leads to populism and the right and bigotry and whatever. So our goal is to pressure the technocracy to be more open and inclusive and to, like, not bash people for being gay or having other views or whatever else. But we can't fundamentally imagine democracy opening up possibilities for the left. And I think that's extremely dangerous. And it's no surprise that in this era we have, Hamilton is the most popular musical on Broadway. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
we have...
going to be at the DNC.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, because to me it is, you know, I think, by the way, Hamilton's a very admirable figure for his age. But I think very much, like, shows this kind of contempt for democracy and this idea that, you know, the best we could hope for is rule by enlightened bureaucrats, and there's certain things that should be out of democratic kind of control. And, you know, and there's that. And I think it's not just kind of media types. It's not just these types of social media. I think it's everyone with a 401k who is looking at that, you know, how much money they lost over the weekend. you know, just being like, okay, you know, this tells us something about democracy and, you know, how people don't know their own interests. And, you know, I think the left's response needs to be with politics. We need to say, no, we believe in democracy. We just believe in organizing people. We need to believe in giving people options. And we think that if people are given options, they'll, through collective action, pursue things in their material interests. People aren't given options or given two options they hate. They're going to, you know, maybe choose something you don't like, or more likely, and this is actually the true story of the referendum that's been buried, they're going to just abstain. The British working class did not vote for Leave. It also did not vote for Remain. They decided to stay at home, probably because their bosses had them working for 10 hours that day.
Right.
And probably also because they just didn't think that either side was really right for them. And that's a real story of this.
They were right.
And a lot of other democracies.
And they were right.
Absolutely.
Bhaskar Sankar, I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to our next on and off air conversations, man. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Take care.
Take care. All right, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half, where we have sound from Hamilton. No, I'm just playing. Marco Rubio doesn't trust Trump with the launch codes, but at least he's not Hillary. I forgot someone was saying this the other day. They were like Marco Rubio is like telling his grandkids, like with a backdrop of like a mushroom cloud while they're like in hazmat suits, like at least grandpa didn't support Hillary Clinton. We've got some sound from the DNC platform committee. Cornel West cannot support the platform. That was a mess. We got a bunch of pieces of sound for you and some stories out of Honduras. The IMs are open. 646-257-3920. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. Fresh episode dropping tomorrow. Go to Majority Report Kickback, where you can get our Jet.com link as well as our Amazon link. Become a member of the Majority Report today. majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show gets to have conversations like we just had. Mark Blythe will be on tomorrow, so you get the real deep dive and real understanding of all the economics of it. He is amazing. Really excited we're having him on. Everybody else, if you're listening live, obviously we're going to go to the fun half. If you're a freebie and you're listening later, goodbye. Hopefully you'll become a member and join us on the fun half in the future. And if you're a member, well, see you on the fun half.